So in 1987 or early 1988, somewhere around there, this seems to happen with a lot of bands I was in. It was either because I pulled the trigger too fast, or I just knew something everybody else didn't know yet, quit when I should have. I think it's the latter, but you never know. So that was the end of the Heartbeats for me. Like I said, they went on for another couple of years. Went in to record again, did some gigs in Boston, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it didn't add up to anything. But right around that time, I started hanging with this guy who used to come see us a lot. I don't even remember how I met him. He was a Worcester firefighter, and his name is Ken Baxter. He was an aspiring songwriter, and he had all kinds of really nice equipment. So he had like his own recording studio. And like I said, I was kind of drifting. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. He was a big talker, and he knew how to convince you that you got to work with him. Mm. So I did. And we did a few of my songs, but it was all about him. It was all about his songs. And I was so desperate to have an avenue into success that I convinced myself that this was awesome. Yeah. You know, in retrospect, I look back and it was slick and everything, but his songs weren't that great. He had a couple of moments of, you know, inspiration, but it was like I was doing it because he was convincing me to do it and because he had equipment. And that lasted for a good year and a half. We even tried to put together a play because he was really into acting too. We did come up with a fantastically creative name for the musical, even though it never amounted to anything, but the name of it was, and it was his idea, The Bewilderness. I thought that was the greatest made-up name. Recorded. He had two sons that would always watch us in the studio. One was Alex, and the other was Nikolai. And at the time, God, Nikolai might have been 11 or 12, and Alex was maybe 7 or 8. You know, they were really young. You know, after we finished those couple of years of working together constantly, and we fell apart, I hardly ever saw Ken ever again. So he's, you know, he's the type of guy who's got a really, really strong ego, and really let it get in his way. That's all I'll say about him because, you know, I have fond memories of him too. And it turns out, this is really the main reason why I wanted to include this in my story. It turns out that his son, Nikolai, just kept listening and listening and listening, and his musical ear kept getting better and better and better. He went to college for music production, and nowadays, he's busy collecting Oscars. He started off specializing in Latin music, so he got a couple of Grammys for sound engineering and on a Latin record. But then he switched over to movies. Hmm. He was a sound engineer on the movie La La Land. And if you recall, any of you movie buffs out there who may have been watching the Oscars on the night that La La Land was one of the nominees, along with Moonlight, the wrong movie was called as the winner of Film of the Year, of all things, you know. And it was Warren Beatty who made the big mistake in his announcement speech, and the winner is, and he said the wrong name. And he said La La Land, and all the cast members and behind-the-scenes people of La La Land were up on stage smiling, congratulating each other, and I looked into the midst of the crowd, and there was Nikolai Baxter, who happened to be one of the sound engineers on a musical, La La Land. So he was, you know, a big part of it. Wow. And it was really good for him. Mm. And he's up for another one this year.
Wow.
And the movie is Maestro.
Oh, geez, yeah.
Maestro,
yeah,
about, yeah, Leonard Bernstein. Yeah. Apparently, he did all the sound engineering of the live orchestral scenes, you know, where there's Bernstein conducting and that, yeah, type of thing. Yeah. He's up for another Oscar.
Wow.
And so he's on top of the world. And I remember him as a nice, humble kid, just like standing behind us while we were working in the studio. So that's the story of Nikolai Baxter. So now we head into the 90s, and I've left behind all the projects that I had in the 80s. The 80s were a very busy time. There was a lot of successful stuff that went on. Oh my goodness, it was filled with great, great things. I just didn't find anything that I could ride into the sunset on. So now we go into the 90s, and I'm getting deeper into my marriage. We have a second child who's now 34 years old. It's really hard to believe. That's Andrew, my son. So the 90s begin with, when are you going to get a real job? I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, maybe I should. So I actually got a job with the post office, yeah, which is a coveted job, you know. Started in Worcester, and then I got a job at the next level up of seniority in Natick. And around that time, unfortunately, split with my wife and moved into an apartment. We didn't get divorced, but it was like I needed space or something. I don't know. So I was commuting to Natick every day. I'd leave when it was dark. I'd get home when it was dark, you know, because it was during the winter. And I was so depressed. I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I would see my kids, obviously. You know, I'd go see them at the house, or they'd come see me at the apartment or whatever. It wasn't like I was not seeing the kids. And I had this job. I'm like, all right, I'll just plow through with this. And I remember just, you know, going ahead and doing it. And then I got a phone call. I got a phone call from my friend John Webster. And John, at the time, was playing with Down East. And, you know, they were at the peak of their popularity. You know, they'd play 3 weddings a week most of the year. He told me that the guitar player just left, wanted to know if I wanted to join. And I'm just getting settled into this job at the post office. Huge decision. Yeah. You know, for me, it was like, I told him, I said, I have to think about this for a couple of days. The biggest thing was that if I joined Down East, I'd be making considerably more money a year than with the post office, but it's not guaranteed money. The attitude around the house was, we've got to have steady income. You know, and by this time I had got it, because I mean, my income through my adult life, it was up and down, sometimes drastically, and my wife was very patient about the whole thing. And so, you know, when I got that call from Down East, there was a lot of skepticism, but it was Down East. I told her how much money I'd be making, and I had moved into my own apartment, so I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. But right away, the money started pouring in. I look back on that decision. I'm so glad I made the decision I made. Yeah. Because the other one would have been safe and boring as hell. And all the things that happened after it wouldn't have happened. Mm. You know, there wouldn't be any Hot House. I wouldn't have made any CDs. Maybe I would have. I don't know. But my life would have been so different. The 90s took off as the decade of Down East. For me, that was basically what you would call GB, or general business music. So it was music as a business, not music as me trying to make it. I didn't mind that, though, because it was a great band and they were all great people. And it was fun. It was fun being in the Cadillac of wedding bands. We used to have this joke slogan that we would say to ourselves in private, and it was a takeoff on the Hallmark slogan. So it was, Down East, when you care enough to spend the very most. You know, so they were, you know, and the guys in the band and Susan too. But it was a whole different life for me. I mean, we'd get booths at wedding expos. To, you know, drum up business. And, you know, of course, we had to have matching tuxedos and all this stuff. So it was so different for me. I enjoyed my career with them, which almost lasted the whole decade. Meanwhile, when I joined Down East, you know, I became especially close with the other guys in the band, Donnie. And Donnie's the drummer, the leader of the band, and his sister, Susan, is the singer and master of ceremonies. Donnie and I, and John, our bass player, the one who called me initially, we're all massive Beatle fans and massive fans of 60s pop music. So we decided to start a band on our own called The Time Machine. And we immediately started working kind of regularly. I just looked at my calendar from 1992 the other day. We were playing every Tuesday at the Firehouse Cafe and every Wednesday at the Tipperary Pub. and then occasionally on weekends. And then we had all those weddings for Down East. So I was working, making money. So as if I wasn't busy enough, meanwhile, I got a call from Charlene Arsenal, who at the time was the entertainment editor at Worcester Magazine, asking me if I'd like to try to write some stuff. I had contributed a couple of articles in the past, and she was looking for somebody to write regularly. It was something I've always been interested in. I mean, really. And it doesn't have anything to do with music, although the articles all had to do with music. It's just that I was writing the article rather than being the musician. It took off because I found that I could really spin up a kind of a neat sentence. You know, I discovered that there was a real talent there. Charlene liked it. It also gave me a chance to go see some shows on free. And so I ended up writing for Worcester Magazine for 15, 20 years. Didn't stop until a few years ago. So maybe 25 years I wrote for Worcester Magazine under different editors. Charlene Arsenault, you know, this is just entertainment editors. Walter Byrd Jr., he really gave me a lot of leeway. During his tenure, I would write reviews of shows that were like up at the Bull Run, and I got to see so many fantastic shows. And I got to be friends with George, who was owner of the Bull Run, and I'd always get really good seats for the shows, and it would always be two complimentary seats, so Mary and I would go to see all these great, great shows. It was a really good run, and it was based on my writing, and I ended up writing one cover story during the Walter Byrd era that was about two local musicians who both had suffered some very bad injuries to slow down their career, let's say. It was nominated for a New England Press, I forget what the name of the organization is, but for the best cover story award. And so we got to go to the banquet in Boston somewhere, and it was like, here I am with all the big writers. So I enjoyed that. It was a little side thing I thought was worth mentioning. Yeah. It was fun, and it was fun not pressuring myself to write a hit song or put together a hit band or, you know, that mentality. I let go of it, and it was kind of a relief, but it didn't last long. I just never outgrew that. And so when we get into the second half of the 90s, a lot of that stuff starts to bear fruit. So, yeah, after the 80s were over and I headed into the 90s, you know, the money that I was making with Down East was life-saving for me, really. So I liked the idea of playing with wedding bands. I mean, plus I had a tux I needed to wear. I left Down East. I'm not quite sure the sequence of events. But I ended up being in one of the rival wedding bands who were really good, too. And it was Dazzle. That name always cracks me up.
That is funny.
It's like, Dazzle.
Dazzle.
Ooh, Mano. Oh, God.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, they worked.
They worked.
Yeah. With a couple of really great people in that band. It included Ron we met on drums, and it included Doug O'Malley on bass, and Pete DePasquale on the guitar. Mm. A couple of various female singers that we had. Because you had to have a female singer at wedding bands.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, at weddings. And, they, you know, we had two during the history of the band that were very, very good. And we had a good career for a good 5 years. Towards the beginning of it, this is a little aside that was an extraordinary story that unfortunately ended almost as fast as it began. It's painful to talk about. It's the best band I was ever in.
Yeah.
Ever. And it featured Ron on drums, Pete DePasquale on guitar, myself on guitar and keyboards, and Michael Jude on bass, and his girlfriend on lead vocals. Everyone was great. Michael Jude was really at a peak of creativity. The name of the group was Bongo Kitty. That was christened by Michael Jude. he had an absolute world-stopping voice, and so did she. We all just kind of knew what we had to do. It was this late 80s, early 90s ideal that we were going to put into the music. And it just happened to be that I had some really good songs waiting to be performed.
And here's Forces of Change, written by Jim Perry, performed by Bongo Kitty.
Recorded four songs so that we'd have something to show to record companies. And we were all convinced that this was it. We finally have it. Ronnie was, in particular, was so excited. You know, he was like, I'm going to be a recording star. I'm going to be a recording artist. And we were all feeling that way.
And here's a piece of Hold On, Little Sister, written by Michael Jude, performed by Bongo Kitty.
there was something a little strange about the vibe with Mike and his girl. Well, as it turns out, they were experimenting a little bit with the Big H. They were very secretive about the whole thing, so I'm not going to disparage either one of their names by giving misinformation or anything like that, because I still love the both of them, but I hate them for what they did. We did a premiere gig, world premiere gig, at Gilrain's, the great famous blues club on Main Street in Worcester. All of our friends were there. It was an exciting night. All the people that mattered were there, and they all thought the band was incredible. I remember Walter Crockett, one of the great writers of Worcester Magazine and then the Telegram and all that, you know, a local legend, came up to me when we were done with our set and said, this might be the best thing I ever heard come out of Worcester.
Wow.
I mean, that's what he said. The buzz was intense, but you're not going to believe this. Mm-hmm. The next day, they disappeared.
Wow.
And headed to New York. And we couldn't get a hold of them.
Oh, Jesus.
And that was that. It was the end of that.
Wow.
The next day. Every once in a while, Ronnie and I will still have conversations where we go, can you believe what happened?
Okay.
You know, I actually ran into Mike last year at the summer concert series. I sort of half jokingly said to him, I never knew how I was going to react the next time I saw you, because frankly, I have a really big bone to pick with you. And I was being friendly and smiley and stuff like that. And he looked at me like, almost like, don't talk about that. And he didn't acknowledge anything like, oh, I'm really sorry we were going through a strange time. It was almost like he was still in denial about what happened. Where do you listen to those songs?
Yeah.
It's like, this is good. It's so obvious how good it is. That little bomb went off in the middle of the 90s. Bongo Kitty was an extraordinary thing. Very short-lasting, and we still had Dazzle. But, you know, by this time, everybody in Dazzle had been in wedding bands for a good 20 years. I mean, 2 decades, really. So I remember the night that we did this. It was one particular night. It was a private party for a friend of ours, and we were doing the usual songs that we didn't want to do, and the girl that was singing with us, we liked her very much, but her tastes were totally different. We were miserable. So as we're packing down the stuff, we started talking really honestly. Why don't we just start a band that does Beatles songs? You know, I'm tired of, you know what? I'm done. I'm done playing weddings. I mean, it was like this protest, you know. Almost the next day, we started Dr. Robert. And it started off being just Beatles songs. And then immediately we realized, why does it have to be just Beatles songs? We love the Zombies. We love the Association. We love the Yardbirds, blah, 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 blah. And so it just became a band of great songs from the 60s and early 70s. And we grew from there. Dr. Robert was really popular. They're actually still together. One of my most special memories of all the different incarnations that I've had in my career was this band, Dr. Robert. And, you know, a lot of it was because of Ron. Ron, to me, is a life force. Mr. Happy.
Yep.
I just love Ron so much. And Johnny Docimo, he came over into the band from another wedding band. All these wedding bands were starting to, like, you know, swap members and just, you know, have fun with each other because we were all good musicians.
Yeah.
And Johnny Docimo, what a singer. And so he came in and he started singing stuff like All Right Now and songs by Aerosmith and just nailing it. And we took off. We started playing every weekend, you know, at all these places like the Sakura Tokyo. And it was during that period of time where the baby boomers were getting a little older. They were all getting into their 40s and really enjoying going out. The kid, their kids had grown up to the point. We had these huge crowds every night. Yeah. It was so fun. So fun. The 90s were packed with craziness and confusion, but also with so much fun. I made so many friends, you know, between the blues jams and the bands. I made so many friends. I was never alone. And then, as I had said before, Hot House kind of bridged me over into the 2000s. Playing with Down East and the Time Machine, and my calendar was full. It hadn't been that full since I was with Albatross, and we were at the peak of, you know, promoting ourselves back in the 70s. I have a few calendar examples in my paperwork of, like, say, 1992, for example. I believe it might have been May or something like that. And I played, like, 24 nights that month out of 31. Wow. And it was mostly the Time Machine, but it was, you know, all the Time Machine and Down East. So I look back on it, and, you know, John Webster and Donnie Sadowski were in both bands, and so we were like a unit. We were constantly playing together. And I still know them both, and, you know, and I've played with them quite a bit in different incarnations since then, and it's so funny to look back, and it's the same cast of characters throughout your life, you know. You know, as far as the first half of the 90s, other than playing with those two bands and really writing a lot of songs in my own private time, I still hadn't gotten into the idea that I could record, you know, so I would be recording stuff on my little tiny cassette player, and I still have a few of those in my drawer somewhere, and they sound awful. It was just reference stuff. My whole life, really, my whole adult life, I was obsessed with songwriting. Let's face it. I was obsessed with, I was envious of really, really great songwriters and envious of the perfect song. And it wasn't just a rock and roll fantasy. It was from my mother bringing me to see musicals and hearing songs written by Rodgers and Hammerstein. And it was all types of songs. I loved the American Songbook with the Sinatra songs and all that stuff. Sammy Kahn and all the great songwriters, right from when I was a young person, had something to do with my organ lessons back when I was a kid. And, you know, everything I'd learned was from the show tunes. I'm getting married in the morning. All that stuff, you know. And so I learned how to appreciate a good melody and a good lyric and all that stuff right from the start. And in the 90s, I really put the pedal to the metal. Some of it was junk, but I was just practicing. I understood that a great song is part inspiration, just, you know, it's almost like an accident, you know. You get chosen. Yep, here it comes. Here comes that great song. It's going to be me this time. You know, it's like it's floating around in the air. I kept working on that. There was a period of time during the middle of the early 90s when I actually moved out of the house, got an apartment. Personally, a tough time. And then when we got divorced, you know, I still saw the kids all the time. I never missed a payment. I'm proud of that. And we, you know, we both tried very, very hard to keep things as normal as possible for the kids. I got a job driving special needs vans for the Worcester Bus Company through my brother, who was a bus driver. And I really kind of enjoyed that job a lot because I got to learn about what it takes to find happiness in this world when you have a lot of limitations. These people were unbelievable. You get to know them by a first name basis, and they'd get in the truck, tie down the wheelchair, and they'd be, you know, crunched over with, you know, a back that doesn't work or whatever. And they'd look at me and go, "Hi, Jim. Aww. What a beautiful day, isn't it?" And I'd have to go, you jerk, you know, thinking to myself, you jerk, why are you complaining to yourself about life? You know, it was kind of like a really great perspective on life for me. It was about 3 or 4 years I did that. Then they wanted me to switch to the big buses. So there's another career I could have had, but I couldn't drive them. I was awful.
It's too big.
And they knew right away, so they pulled me right off.
He's a musician. Don't let him drive the bus.
Yep. So that was the first half of the 90s encompassed in all of that. So there was really no bands that were seriously original or, you know, attempting to make it in music or, you know, all that stuff was in the past. I was just kind of enjoying being a dad and enjoying making money playing music for once. And that's what it came down to. So I guess it's logical to divide the 90s into two. Mm-hmm. And now we're heading into the second half. And the dividing line really is symbolized more than anything else by my divorce. I dove into making money playing music and trying to improve my personal style as much as possible. In the process, somehow I got caught up with the blues. I discovered how really great it is. And even the old blues, I got to confess that up until then, if I ever heard a record by like Willie Dixon or Muddy Waters, or I'd scratch my head and go, this kind of sucks. You know, they don't know how to play. They can't sing. The recordings are awful. It was all ridiculous white bread opinions, you know, because I had no idea. You know, I did remember, you know, my influences from Mike Lynch back in the Albatross days, because he was a big fan of anything soulful. But from that point on, I was chasing that golden ring, and it was all about pop music and big hits. And I realized at that point when I started listening again how far off I got from it, especially with that project with Ken Baxter in the late 80s. I looked back at it in 95. I looked back at it in embarrassment. I really did. Like, how white can you get? So, dove into the blues, started writing songs that were more blues-oriented, introduced Ken Jason to the blues a little bit. So his lyrics were a little bit more, you know, the cadences were a little bit more like blues songs. It was really interesting. You know, we really tried. And I think I wrote some really, really good blues songs, which, you know, I'm very proud of. There's one called Vigilante from the Hot House album, which is really great. And it has unbelievable lyrics from Ken Jason. I'm so proud of that song.
I've seen some fighting in the street among the gang war elite. There've been some bad times here going down. I've seen some bloody broken bones, some neighborhoods overthrown, and no one's safe anymore in this town. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the vigilante rise, 'cause if Johnny Law can't help his fellow man, then people gonna take the law into their own hands. Yeah.
was a robbery yesterday, and the robbers got away, and the cops say they can't do a thing. They got no probable cause, so people keep breaking laws. Well, the innocent man bound to take a swing. The vigilante rise, 'cause if Johnny Law can't help his fellow man, the people gonna take the law into their own hands. Look out.
Good recording too, because the Hot House album was the first time that I actually worked with Roger LaValle in the studio. I discovered his brilliance and never turned back. So that was great. So the name of the first Hot House album was Melting Pot, and but there was a lot of variety in the music. But the thread, the common thread, was blues. There were some pop songs. I was really obsessed with the Pretenders at the time. So there's a song on there called The Fear of Commitment, which completely is me trying to write like Chrissie Hynde. But the words are Ken Jason's. Yeah!
closer we get, the stranger we feel. A miracle midnight, baby, so goddamn real. The longer we love, the harder it gets. A miracle midnight, baby, it has its regrets. If you go, I feel low. If you stay, baby, that's okay. Cause I'll just deal with however I feel. I hope that you won't walk away. The more that we talk, the deeper we touch. The fear of commitment, baby, is a little too much. A little too much.
Discovering all kinds of stuff because it was my first experience recording my songs. It was intense. Yeah, so that was 1997. Hot House continued to play. Then we added an extra person after the fact, and that was Mike Lanigan, who became a solid member of the band for quite a few years until our demise, as a matter of fact. Mike was great. Once I got a taste of being in the studio, I wanted more. So I decided, why don't I record my own album? So that's what happened. I ended up dating somebody at the time, and she helped out financially, and I got to thank her for that. But, you know, I was scraping money together to work with Roger again, and we came up with this amazing album, you know, my first solo album, and it's called Moment of Truth. The title song, I can't believe what I accomplished with it. You know, the first four or five songs on it are, it's like I had come home, and I, you know, this is what I'm here for. It was quite an amazing experience, and I'm still really proud of the music.
You're this. You're
That was the song Category by Jim Perry, and here's his song Big Car.
As we entered the 2000s, that's what I was working on. Still playing with Hot House and really, really getting into the idea of being an original artist and a great guitar player. And the way that I went into the guitar player thing and the blues was finding out about local blues jams. which I had never even, I mean, it never entered my consciousness before. And so I heard about one that was out in East Brookfield, a couple towns outside of Worcester, at a little tiny pub called Frank's, Frank's Pub, a pretty well-known blues jam, and they would have guest artists every week, but they had a house band. You know, it was pretty popular. All the Brookfield folks would come there every week. So I started going there every week too. Somewhere along the line, and I apologize to the guitar player at the time for not remembering his name, but somewhere along the line he decided he wanted to quit. And so I thought, I can do this. I had no idea if I could or not, but I mean, I was confident. The host of that jam was Mr. George DeLomo, and he gave me the chance. He said, well, why don't you try it? And so I started, and I never stopped. Opened up an entirely new chapter in my life. Some really good successes in the future, which we'll talk about later on. But the beginning of the whole blues jam thing was right around the turn of the century. Well, I had left the 90s with all kinds of new images of what I could be. It was a fractured decade. But there were a lot of things that I just picked up and ran with, and now they were forming into something solid.